so much more than survival. I'm sure we can all think of a particularly memorable meal that we've shared with other people. So just take a moment now to bring one to mind, if you can. I wonder why you remember it. What was important about it? Was it the food, the setting, the occasion, the company and the conversation, or perhaps something significant that happened there? I wonder. Last autumn, I had the privilege of attending two very different and memorable meals. The first one was a formal dinner for about 130 people held in the rather grand surroundings of the British Embassy in Istanbul. So some old friends of ours who've served in the Foreign Office since the 1980s threw a joint 60th birthday party and invited family and friends and former colleagues from across the globe to celebrate it with them. And we all dressed up to the nines and we dined beneath crystal chandeliers waited on by embassy staff. It was wonderful. The second meal took place in the living room of a flat in Dorking. A group of Syrian friends wanted to express their appreciation to me and two other volunteers who'd been helping them to learn English. So dressed in our everyday clothes, we sat around a cloth that they'd laid on the floor of their one reception room, and we enjoyed a wonderful meal of stuffed vine leaves, chicken and almonds with rice, and a beautifully sculpted fruit salad. And I have to say that on both those occasions, I felt equally honoured to be the recipients of such kindness and generosity, to listen and talk and share life with others as we ate together. So studies have shown that there are many advantages to eating together whenever and wherever that happens. Apparently, it benefits us both physically and psychologically. It slows us down. It reduces stress. It improves communication skills. It strengthens bonds. And it creates a sense of security and belonging. And apparently, when colleagues do it, it improves their collaboration with one another. So in her book, Eating Together, Alice Juliet argues that dining with others can radically alter our perspectives, reducing our perceptions of inequality and causing us to see people of different races, genders, and socioeconomic backgrounds as more equal than we would in other social scenarios. But we must acknowledge that the table can also be an uncomfortable place, a place of tension and conflict. And I imagine most of us have experienced that at some point in our lives. Perhaps trying to persuade a reluctant toddler to eat vegetables. Perhaps arbitrating between quarrelling teenagers. Maybe trying to negotiate the huge challenges of an eating disorder. Or struggling to remain civil when relationships are strained. As well as being a place of celebration and connection and community, the shared table can highlight underlying problems. Yet from Genesis to Revelation, the Bible contains numerous examples of people eating together in all kinds of ways. And the table is also often used as a sign or a symbol of God's kingdom and reign, as in today's passage from Isaiah. In Psalm 23, the psalmist speaks of God preparing a table for him. And Revelation 19 talks about the wedding supper of Christ. The early Christians, we know, ate together in their homes. And here, breaking bread is referring to sharing food rather than to celebrating communion. And of course, some of the most significant events in Jesus' life, as well as the stories he told, centered on shared meals. Sometimes he was the host, as in the breakfast on the beach. Sometimes he was the guest. Sometimes he served others, and sometimes he allowed them to serve him. But he ate with many different people and in many places, on hillsides and in homes, at weddings and Passover meals. So what can we learn from his example? Well, firstly, let's think about how he shared food with others. In the gospel story that we've just heard, it was a basic picnic on the beach. Fish and bread baked over a fire. Nothing grand, in fact, quite ordinary. And seemingly pretty spontaneous too, because the disciples were invited to bring some of their catch to supplement what Jesus had provided so that there'd be enough for everyone. Bring and share. The feeding of the 5,000 was also extremely simple fare, bread and fish again. Staple food, a boy's packed lunch miraculously multiplied so that everyone was fed. But Jesus also ate in people's homes. Never one to waste an opportunity, he invited himself to Zacchaeus' house, doubtless for food and drink, and on other occasions he dined with Pharisees. And then, of course, there was the wedding at Cana, which presumably was a lavish celebratory meal. So for Jesus, eating together could be planned or spontaneous. It could be public or private. It could be a feast, or it could be a very simple meal. Secondly, let's remind ourselves of who Jesus shared meals with. Well, we know that he ate with his friends Mary and Martha and Lazarus, with his disciples, with social pariahs like tax collectors and prostitutes, with a random crowd who followed him up a hillside, and with people of influence like the Pharisees, who were often his sternest critics and had a very different viewpoint from his own. Essentially, Jesus ate with anyone and everyone, and he made no exclusions. Perhaps he felt more comfortable with some than others, but he didn't pick and choose his company for his own enjoyment or to meet with social and cultural expectations. In fact, he caused great offence amongst the Pharisees by having dinner at Matthew's house along with a group of tax collectors and sinners. What shocked the Pharisees was that he mingled with these individuals, with their questionable occupations and dubious lifestyles, their diseases and disabilities. He appeared to be identifying with them, stooping, if you like, to their level. But Jesus wouldn't be dictated to by convention. He had something to offer these people, and he recognized their spiritual need and wanted to meet it. So that brings us thirdly to why Jesus ate with other people. Well, clearly, shared meals were part of the rhythm of life then, as they are for some now. For Jesus, though, it wasn't always about socializing for its own sake. He often chose to use these occasions to demonstrate his divine power and to fulfill his earthly ministry. So, for example, several of his miracles took place around shared meals, feeding of the 5,000, the wedding at Cana, and the extraordinary catch of fish in today's story. But meals could also be a place of recognition and revelation. You may remember that on the road to Emmaus, the two followers only recognized Jesus at the table when he broke bread with them. And he used the context of a shared meal to have some of his most significant conversations, not least with the disciples at the Last Supper. As we've just heard, it was immediately after the breakfast on the beach that he had a very challenging and yet profoundly healing conversation with Peter. Jesus used this opportunity to restore relationship following Peter's denial, and then he commissioned him to feed my sheep, not to nourish their bodies, but their souls. And the table was also a place of reconciliation and forgiveness in the story of the prodigal son. So how does all this apply to us? What's the challenge? Where's the challenge? Surely we're practicing this holy habit already. After all, we've got so many wonderful and inclusive activities and events around food at Holy Trinity, which provide opportunities for sharing and building friendship and faith. We've got celebrate breakfasts, community lunch, the Monday cafe, Papua fish and chip quiz, tickets still available, baby meals, women's group, harvest supper, Prosecco and cake after church on special occasions, and it goes on. And I believe we should be encouraged by that, but not complacent. Interestingly, most of those things take place in church buildings. So what else might we do? What about eating together in our homes or in coffee shops or in workplace dining rooms, if there are such things anymore, or in the Prince of Wales? Or even like the minister and writer Andrew Roberts, on a pavement somewhere. Let me tell you his story. In his book, Holy Habits, he says, "One of the most memorable meals I've ever shared was with some homeless men on Princes Street in Edinburgh. I was working in the city a few days before Christmas and went to visit the German market on the south side of the street. The market was alive with light, music, laughter, and all sorts of treats to buy and eat. On the other side of the street, the homeless men were beginning to bed in for the night, in the cold, in the shop entrances. I went back to the market and got some food and took it across to share with them. It was a holy moment. Their gratitude and smiles were as bright as the lights across the road. As we parted, the mutual expressions of God bless were as alive as if the one born outside in a stable whose birth we were celebrating had been physically there pronouncing God's blessing himself." I wonder, are we willing to be flexible and spontaneous like that, looking out for opportunities in the daily round, just as Jesus did? Maybe impromptu hospitality and food sharing has become a thing of the past. People don't seem to drop in like they used to. And if it's our home, it can feel a bit unpredictable, inconvenient, risky even, when we haven't agreed a date and time and arranged a venue and cleaned the house and planned and shopped a menu which will impress our guests. But it needn't be about putting on a show or demonstrating culinary prowess or returning an invitation that we owe someone. Those things certainly have their place on the right occasion, making our guests feel treated and special. But I think we can overcomplicate it and put unnecessary pressure on ourselves. We can allow what the chef Delia Smith calls the pride of perfection to creep in. And of course, it doesn't even have to be a meal. Coffee and a biscuit is fine, and it can happen anywhere. Rather ironically, the phrase to make a meal of something means to take more time and care on something than is necessary. What matters is, after all, being open and generous and hospitable and expressing the love of God and recognizing the presence of Christ whenever and wherever we eat with others. In 2003, the Methodist Church brought out a publication entitled His Presence Makes the Feast. His Presence Makes the Feast. With Jesus present at the table, anything can happen. So let's be open to the Holy Spirit's prompting and expectant of what he might do. Let's allow God to surprise us. Let's see the table or the picnic mat or the park bench or even the pavement as a place where the Spirit is at work, a place of possibility and potential blessing. So what might that mean for you, for me? Maybe in line with our church vision, we might open our homes to neighbours or colleagues, inviting someone we've never invited before. Share a meal with someone who regularly eats alone. Or maybe here at Holy Trinity, we could have an open table once a month where people offer spare places at their Sunday lunch table for anyone who'd like to join them. Risky, you don't know who would come. There are so many ways that we could cultivate this holy habit. In psychology, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, a habit is defined as an automatic reaction to a specific situation. An automatic reaction to a specific situation. Perhaps we might call it something that becomes second nature. I hope and pray that this holy habit will become second nature to us as we go out into the world this week. Amen.